Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate.
Now listen to this, I'll tell you about heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the
loss of God.
I'll tell you about the hopeless night, the meager food, the soul forgot. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron soul.
And welcome to Onto Eve. Here on Summertime.
I'm your host, Don Pardo. I'm not surprised at all.
What?
That it's Onto Eve.
It is Onto Eve. It's a glorious Onto Eve. I was just outside in the elements. The cold front has moved through the beautiful downtown Larchmont area. And we are entertaining temperatures of 30 degrees. I could actually feel my body as I came back into the building.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, in the last 3 or 4 days. Of course, I've been battling the will to live around here.
Mm. I don't know how you stay in there with no heat on at night.
Well, poverty, number one, is a big magnet. Keeps you in the chair, keeps you working, keeps you effort,
mm-hmm.
keeps you fresh. You know, about, what, 25, 30 years of insomnia, and sprinkle a little bit of dysfunctional computer on it, and pretty soon it's dawn.
Wow.
Yeah. But I am making some efforts. For those of you in the Colorado listening area, get your butt over to somerspace.org and put a little slash after that and type in somaday.html and then sign up for the big Soma Day celebration April 2nd. We have 20 seats, 20 seats only. You could sign up now. You could sign up 2, 3, 4, 5 at a time if you want. The rates are there. And we would love to accommodate you with a little somatic method, a little summer day afternoon in Broomfield, Colorado, coming up April 2nd. So I'm going to make that announcement until one of you sapes actually signs up. We have a guest on tonight that's actually pretty famous in her own right in the Somaverse.
Mm-hmm.
She'll be joining us at 9:30. She's at a previous engagement at 7 p.m.
9:30, huh?
Yeah, so our guest will be joining us a little late. So all you archivers, just feed forward to about 9:30 or so, and you want to hear Martha. And we're going to be talking about movement science and her work in developing relationships between, let's just say, the physical and the mental realm using the magic of the Soma. So we actually have a legitimate somatic expert on tonight. So maybe someday, maybe we're going to find out maybe, how you actually get people to kind of bite the somatic apple, so to speak. You know, it hasn't happened yet. So, but in other news, since it is Onto Eve, I figured that we should discuss this. Comedian Rush Limbaugh has been all over the news the last 3 or 4 days. Every day it gets better. And I guess today he called out Obama on the radio show and challenged him to an on-air debate.
Really?
Yes, it was so poor.
He is just full of balls, that guy.
Yes, well, he's Onto, and he's got a microphone in front of him. I mean, what else do you need? You know, so if we can get over to the YouTube, I'm sure there's plenty of that over there. Which is Rush Limbaugh. I mean, if you saw him last week, he's really on a roll. He's about a 5 or 6 day news cycle now. Where last week he was at that CPAC convention in Washington, D.C., and he made a lot of statements there that were been picked apart by the Democrats. But basically, every single day, somebody in the Obama administration, whether it's the press guy or whatever, will make a Limbaugh reference, and then he goes on the air from noon to 3 and blasts them for 3 hours, because if you ever listen to Limbaugh's show, there's hardly any callers, a couple times as a guest. But most times it's just Rush telling you the truth, according to Rush. It's great. So if you don't know what an Onto is, and you haven't been over to somerspace.org and clicked on the Learn Me Some TSM Now link in the middle of the page so you can learn how to make these distinctions, the profile we're talking about, what happened?
I don't know.
Did you hear that?
The hand went up.
I said I'm now in the host queue. Have I been on the air since then? Did you hear me right?
Yeah.
All right, I don't know what. Another Blog Talk Radio moment here on Onto Eve. Getting its last Philo kinks out before we turn over to the boss.
That's right. It was Philo week. Boy, could I tell you it was Philo week.
Yes. There's a lot of people in the fetal position.
And on the other end of the stick, a lot of people being very lovey-dovey and, you know,
mm-hmm.
that kind of stuff. Ugh.
I don't know what that means, but.
Ugh.
But anyway, long story short with this Rush thing is that we've talked about the science of ideas or memetics the last couple of weeks on the show, and how people get hooked into these things, and they can't. It's almost like mind candy. You can't get enough of it. And Rush is one of those guys that's got this 20 million people in the audience. They call them ditto heads and stuff. And basically, the sound of his voice becomes comfort food, becomes a security blanket. So it doesn't matter what he's saying. He can go on there and go ba 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 for an hour, and people will think it's golden because it's coming out of his mouth.
I prefer to hear that out of his mouth, actually.
That'd be kind of funny if he did that, yeah. But I do have a clip here from Katie Couric. Let's see if it plays.
Ugh.
Talking about Rush on Letterman. I guess it was.
What about this phone?
Let's take a listen to this.
Don't do this to me, please. He gets up in Washington, and he's the keynote speaker at some function, and he comes up, he looks like an Eastern European gangster. You know, he's got the black jacket on, silk shirt, and it's unbuttoned like, oh, yeah. When you think Rush Limbaugh, you think, ooh, let's see a little flesh. Honestly, you know, what is he doing?
Well, I think, you know, on a serious note,
yeah.
although I'm thrown by the Rush Limbaugh flesh
yeah.
in the same, in
you
one
not
sentence,
yeah.
But I think it's indicative of this power vacuum that exists right now in the Republican Party, and he's filling it right now. And there are ideological differences about the role of government, but
yes.
certainly I just don't know if this country's in a position where they can really waste time talking about different sort of approaches and whether Keynesian economists, you know, agree with other economists.
And he sees the approach that Obama and his staff have chosen as threatening to free market, democratic way of life.
And the deficit is, you know, befalling our children and grandchildren. But, you know, I think the minority party just, it's their job to kind of be rabble-rousers.
Yeah, but he just looks like, I mean, we got...
This is mine.
Yeah, we get used to Republicans like Newt Gingrich, and Newt resembles a Newt. but a smart guy. And now all of a sudden you got Rush Limbaugh. I'm sorry, the casino's closed. It's one of... What? What? Leave us alone. My God.
So much for my interview
with Rush. All right, then. There you go. As the clicks and the whistles come out. And XO, take on Ananto. You just did it again.
I know, I had to.
Effer? Jesus, it's good thing the quality of the show is so high we can handle that. Did you find the Ashbrook reference about this Stephen Russo guy yet?
No, all I found was 400 people with the same name.
Oh, well, let's see if I can find it. But it's basically the gist of the story, which was I only heard the sort of the abridged version of it before, was this dude... decided it'd be really a good idea to have his teenage son and his buddies and a bunch of high school cheerleaders over to his house, and it gets even better. I can't make it up. For a little party, booze him up, put a stripper pole in the middle of the room, have the girls perform and kiss him on the mouth, and then take pictures and post it on Facebook. Tremendous.
Hmm.
I think people think Facebook is, like, invisible.
Did you see what happened with the cops in Silver Lake?
No, I'm not familiar with the local report, no.
Well, the Facebook.
Yeah.
A couple of the police officers
mm-hmm.
were saying really vile things on the mm-hmm. Facebook. And, of course, somebody sent off the information to the powers that be, and they are in deep doo-doo.
What happened?
Well, they posted some stuff about Obama, using the bad word, And then they called the town clerk a vile name, and then someone sent it to her.
Yeah.
And they're just sitting there just spouting off like it's no big deal, even though they're, you know, they're police officers. I'm sorry, but you can't really do that. This is
people think it's like that show Soap, and they think that they're Bert, and they're invisible. You know, and it's just it's just really scary. I'm dating myself with the Soap reference, but what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this story here, I found it. Get on that pole is the title of the story. Dad throws pole dancing party for teens. Stephen Russo sure knows how to throw a party. He just needs to play with people his own age. Russo hosted some wild parties for his 17-year-old son's teenage friends. The court documents were more like a form story straight out of Penthouse magazine. And he's actually an aunt, though, just acting very stupidly eco. He was DJing the party. Hello. The invites for the December romp went to a group of 14 to 16-year-olds. Hey. Girls and boys from Freedom High School in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Court documents of the smoking gun where all the truth ends up, if TMZ doesn't get it first. It says Russo's apparently quite the storyteller. Let the teens drink vodka, rum, and beer, I like this guy, while he entertained them with tales of his sexual exploits. That's the G-rated part. The partiers, along with Dad, mingled in the basement of his home there in Bethlehem, in the tiny town of Bethlehem, where he keeps his featured attraction, a stripper's pole. With the music playing, Dad allegedly shouted out to some of the teenage girls who were dressed in cheerleader outfits, get on that pole. And anything that happens after that sentence usually ends up in some type of court papers. But one of the teens told the police that he had a room for hookups on the second floor called the Cave. Yep, they said the house was a popular hangout. Really? I wonder why. And the Express Times had a great write-up on this part of the story. The fun fizzled when a teacher from Freedom High School took some Facebook pics of the party to the police. He's been arrested and charged with 9 counts of endangering welfare, 8 counts of furnishing alcohol, and 9 counts of corruption of minors.
Oh, man.
This Facebook has become a portal into the lives of people you might never know what's going on. They got a picture of the house here. And
you have to let people on your friends list in order for this to happen.
Well, people on the block had no idea the parties were for teenagers.
Wow.
So, he's just Jenny from the block. Some 17-year-old drank so much that they threw up. Well, that happens. I don't know what that means, but that's not a crime.
No.
9
that's
counts of endangering the welfare. Well, I mean, but the thing, these are 14-year-old girls.
Yeah, that's disgusting.
Now, as we know, the daughter of Philippi, the Bean, is 13, going on 72. But I don't imagine that this man would be able to breathe through his head if I found out that he was hosting a stripper pole party attended by the Bean.
No.
Yeah. I think that would be pretty much that would end itself.
I'd have to bail you out, wouldn't I?
Well, you'd have to. I would be guilty of 9 counts of something at that point. But I can't imagine this guy thinking that for any minute this was a getawayable thing.
No.
Like again, this is an Anto. Again, we're on Anto Eve here, so we have Rush Limbaugh and we have Stephen Russo. So far in the hooch for our little Anto week. Hillary Clinton making news over there, doing a 180 on the whole Israel-Gaza thing, it seems.
What the heck is she saying?
Well, she used to be, when she was a senator from New York and resided here in Chappaqua, she was touting the Save Israel kind of thing. And now she's kind of coming around to the Obama way of looking at the whole situation. It's very fluid, apparently.
Mm.
And she thinks that some of the comments that are being made are inflammatory coming from the Israeli side of the matzah, as it were.
Uh-huh.
And not going over too well.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, actually, this gets into, we were talking about it the other day a little bit. If you can, I don't know if I could get the whole list, but I could effort that. The Obama cabinet has become a dysfunctional sapien all-star team at this point. And let's see if I can get a list, because every day there's one of these guys is doing something dumber than the day before. And I'm just interested to see if Exo Boy is mine in the store. All right, let's see.
I would think he'd be a little overwhelmed. I mean, I started a new job, and I was overwhelmed, and it sure isn't president of the U.S.
Yeah, something tells me that you're doing your reports over there at Open Doors is not as stressful as what old Obama's doing, old bailout is doing.
No, definitely not. And I can understand him being overwhelmed and maybe missing a few things going on.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, I'm just looking at this list here. Joe Biden hasn't done too many stupid things yet. Hillary's been in trouble like every other week, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
This Department of Treasury guy, Geithner, isn't it the guy from Larchmont? Is that him?
Yes, I believe so. Yes.
Beautiful downtown Larchmont. Larchmont's own Timothy Geithner. Everybody hates him. Everyone on Wall Street hates him. Everybody hates him. Gates, the department, the defense guy, he threw George Bush under the bus the other day. You hear that one on Sunday morning talk shows?
No.
They made him compare his experience with Bush and his experience with Obama. He says, Obama's a little more analytical. Just a little.
A little? You know, what?
And then this whole thing kind of exploded about all these inside papers that are going on, that Bush basically was having like a totalitarian, like, you know, shadow government forming with all these. You see all the crap he was trying to pull that they didn't get away with? About, you know, what they wanted to, like, basically search your house and arrest people without warrant. And
oh, brother.
Yeah. Bush was as much as everyone makes it Cheney. Bush had a power like thing going on, like nobody. I couldn't believe it. And Gates knew about it. So that's another guy. Department of Justice Holder's been just kind of new on the job. Isn't that much got on my radar yet? Salazar, he's kind of uppity. Agriculture guy, Phil Sack hasn't done much yet. We haven't got to the farmers yet. This commerce guy. Locke was in trouble a couple days ago. I forgot what he did. He got on the radar. The energy guy, Chu, made some stupid statements, too. The press secretary guy gets in trouble a lot. What's his name?
I don't remember.
No, come on. You got to know
Sorry.
His name. Useless. In a moment, useless.
Yep.
What's his name? The press secretary guy. Gibbs. That's his name, Gibbs. Thanks for nothing.
Anytime.
Well, hey, the gift that keeps on giving, nothing. Let's see. Rahm Emanuel, of course, is the guy that called out Rush. You know, but he's got so many, basically, Obama is a natural loner. Exos are natural loners. They're task-oriented. You give them a task, they're going to complete it. They go on to the next task. You know, very digital the way they operate. And these loose cannons, like Emanuel's and Anto and Hillary's and Anto, you can't put them back in the garbage can. They're going to go off like a bunch of Molotov cocktails if something gets on their radar, and they're going to come at you like the barking dog. And that's why I think he wanted a lot of kind of self-starters that he could just delegate these little areas to, because he's got to sit there kind of in the catbird seat and deal with everything. He's got to deal with the war. He's got to deal with the economy. He's got to deal with the healthcare stuff, you know. And meanwhile, every day, something happens that you know better than me. What did the market do today?
Oh, it was up almost 150.
Okay. So for the week, it's still pretty buried.
Yeah, it's bad. It sucks. Well, I heard through the grapevine from some people who supposedly know stuff, and, you know, you have to take this with a grain of salt, that we're going to have a rally, a small rally, and then it's going to tank below 4,000.
Wow.
And anybody who has money in their retirement accounts that they're planning on living on might want to talk to someone who knows something and make some decisions, because if it does go down that low, it's going to take like 10, 12 years for it to come back. And people who are retired don't necessarily want or have that much time to wait.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. They might like to eat today instead of 12 years from now.
And does this forecast, is this for the calendar year?
Like, say that again?
How long does it take to do all that stuff?
They're saying that the rally could happen like any time now and last for a short period of time and then tank.
So we're going to get to like the summer and then the bottom falls out.
Normally in the summer, things kind of, you know, fizzle out anyway, so I don't know. It's going to be scary.
So what your friends are saying basically is grab your ass with both hands.
Yes.
So why
pull your money out if you need it.
Speaking of hands, why is that stupid little hand still up there?
I don't know. But if it had a rubber glove on it, I'd be worried.
Did it have like a little one? Like...
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
What the heck is that?
It says I'm off the host queue. But was I on the air before that?
Yeah, I heard you.
But has anybody else heard me?
My God. Yeah. Yes, because
what?
Jim in Michigan is listening.
Block
yeah,
radio again,
he
trying to make
me.
A technical difficulty out of a technical difficulty. I tried to find that stupid Block Talk radio player thing. I had to go all the way to the dopey the block we hate to get it.
Oh, jeez.
I couldn't find it. The whole Block Talk radio universe, it wouldn't let me know how to promote my own dopey show. I digress. So, okay, so we've covered Rush Limbaugh. And Hillary, and some of Antos here in Antoise. I'm trying to think of any other Antos I missed that have made news. Of course, our favorite Philo, A-Rod, now has a hip situation.
Oh?
Yes. A cyst in the arse.
Really?
Probably from where his cousin was sticking that needle.
I was just thinking that exact thing.
Oh, it's a common finding. And if you repeatedly put... You know, a needle in your arse, you form a little bit of a scar, and it could develop into a bad little cyst of moon. So he's winging his way to Colorado to have that thing looked at. And then we have another Philo in distress on the Met side of town with Mr. Johan and the elbow that's getting a little cranky. Seems, you know, a typical Philo, gross motor, kind of, let's just say, a little primitive in their movement patterns. He had a knee surgery after the season last year. They took him to camp about maybe 2 or 3 weeks early to test the knee, had him doing knee bends and jumping around like a frog out there, and he was throwing every other day. So he basically threw about 9 or 10 times more than he would have had he just showed up for camp on time. And then, of course, when he started to pitch in any kind of a cycle where there was a little downtime, a little recovery, a little repair, the elbow got a little cranky. And now they're saying it could be, you know, he could miss the opening day start, and he's, you know, $127 million pitcher and all that stuff. And, of course, they have not connected the dots between a knee and an elbow yet. God forbid anyone knows any physiology down there in Florida. So, but I offered my opinion to the New York Baseball Digest crowd, and apparently I'm speaking a different language over there, I was told. They're so clear when they talk. New York Baseball Digest, nybaseballdigest.com, Mike Silva's wonderful program. If you want to go delve into that, it was something posted that I put up there about the spring training. If you want to read a little Soma as it relates to sports, as I try to share the Soma with anyone I can, and of course I'm told I'm speaking another language. Of course, their stat language is so understandable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Bastards. Let's see if I got a little. Play for that.
The fuck you bullshitting me for?
There you go. So anyway, so there's that going on. And then, of course, today, early morning, actually it can only happen this way for this guy, Manny Ramirez signs for 2 years with the Dodgers, Eco at Lodge, after holding out and refusing, I think, 4 or 5 contract offers. In this economy, he had the audacity to refuse getting $45 million over 5 years. And twisted the testicles of the Dodgers enough, and they anteed up, and they're going to pay him that over 2 years.
Hmm.
So he's his Twitter to his teammates was, Manny Wood is back in Hollywood. So we could all rejoice that the Eco got his loot, and he's off their way. And I think one of the quotes I said was. If Manny could play in a league where he could have someone run for him, he could just swing at the bat, just swing, just take swings and not play the outfield, he'd do it because that's all he wants to do. The guy lives to just, you know, sit in the batting cage and just smack balls around and pays no attention to anything. It's perfect. So, you know, we've had pretty much every domain represented with Obama being the XO and a couple of Antos and a couple of Philos and Manny the Eco. So we've covered pretty much
the entire Somaverse there in 24 minutes. We'll bring you the world. So they are. So this guest coming up tonight, now this is like where like playtime ends, because there's somebody actually applying this stuff and getting real results in the world and not just going on blog talk and talking about two people like us.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, two people. Let's see.
You filthy criminies.
There you go. And I just before she gets on the air, she should be coming on in a couple of minutes. I just want to touch on this phenomenon that's going to be coming out, I guess, Thursday or Friday is when it starts, this Watchmen movie. That people are literally, it's almost Star Wars-esque, the way people are anticipating this movie. It's supposed to be just mind-blowing as far as the special effects and stuff. And the gist, and I've only read the gist, I haven't gone on Rotten Tomatoes and read much more about it, but are you into this, by the way, this Watchmen movie? You don't watch the sci-fi stuff.
No.
No.
Not really my bag.
You prefer what?
Vampires.
And Labyrinth? What?
Yes, that and vampires. Anything with a vampire, I'm good with that. But, yeah.
Well, another comic strip movie, and there's been a couple of good ones in the last year or so. Iron Man was good, you know. But this one's got a little wrinkle, because the character, isn't about all good, all bad. It's usually what they do with this comic strip. He's Watchmen. Are what they call interdimensional beings. And they can cross over from one dimension to another. Right? And they're the watchmen. They kind of check out what's going on, what the flow is like in between the dimensions. And one of the early things about somatics that I learned was that, you know, just like certain things conduct electricity, like glass, water, what else? Oh, metal, right? What conducts consciousness? It's not just a body, because otherwise everyone would be dancing at the morgue. It isn't just the mind, because if it was just the mind, then basically you wouldn't need the body at all to animate the thoughts, right? So it is the soma, the relationship between self and surroundings, that actually guides you across different dimensions of consciousness. That's why you can go from a meditative state to a full, you know, five-alarm fire state and a couple of heartbeats. And it's having that awareness of what state you're in. Like right now we're in the state of confusion, trying to communicate soma to a bunch of invisible people. That is really the conductor of consciousness. Not the brain, not the body, not the mind, nothing that you could stick a fork in. Just the soma. And if you understand how to develop an awareness of what type of relationship you're having, which are the domains, that gives you the information. It's like getting feeds from different directions from a weather vane, you know. So when the wind blows onto, and it does often, your belief system is being challenged. And you'll feel it. You'll feel that internal sense of, that's hell no. You disagree. Usually the first response from an onto is no. Think of a two-year-old trying to feed them. No, 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 no. Right?
No, that's right.
Which they refuse you. Not because they don't want the food. They don't want to be told to eat now. They'll eat when they want to, right? But the philo is yes, yes, yes. Agreeable. Receptivity. That's the philo wind. It comes from the south. Kind of tropical, right? Then you have the eco wind from the west, where it's wild and a little unpredictable, right? And then you have that kind of stillness that comes from the east, where the exo wind blows sometimes, and it's very impersonal. So when you have that kind of impression from somebody, what kind of connection you're making, that tells you what dimension that relationship is operating from. And then you can start figuring out, okay, where am I in that space? So it's like it tells you what direction it's coming from, and then the next thing is to figure out the interface, or how does that get my attention? And that starts lighting up different parts of the body. So hopefully when we get Martha on the air here, she's done a lot of this work with conflict and people doing things that are more on the mental level, using the somatic awareness as sort of the instrument to guide you through these things. So hopefully we can get that done, and maybe we can break down a couple of these popular cases like this, because you see it all the time. I think last night, I guess today, and a little bit yesterday, this dopey Bachelor show. Did you hear about this at all? Where the guy broke up with the original girl and then asked out the girl that was the runner-up, and then they said, oh, it was all set up. And
I did hear it mentioned somewhere, and I didn't care, so I shut off.
Well, it was a half a big deal to people that watched the show because they wanted to be real. Of course.
What are you eating?
Da-da-da-da-da. I don't know, but I'm loving it. And, of course, they tried out the body language experts to sort of, ferret out the truth. And just as inanely and as inaccurately as possible, he's lying! And it turned out he really wasn't. So another one of those third-party things. Somatics is completely about first person. It's internal. And I'm telling you that probably 80, 90% of the time, it's not worth sharing with anybody else. Because it's like what's on your TV, what's on your radar, what's on your desktop is relevant to you. That's the conversation you're having within yourself. Interpersonal somatics is much more nonverbal. It's that feeling of being in sync with somebody else. And you know when you're in sync with somebody else, and you know when you're not. It's not a lot of thinking involved. I think one of the problems I think, talking about, the domains and all the stuff we do in the somatic method is that there's a lot of lingo initially to learn to sort of give you a way to kind of frame what's happening so you can recognize it the next time and the next time. So you know when you're standing in front of someone whose primary domain is philo, so to speak, and you know, okay, so they're interested in the relationship we're having, so they want to feel like more friendly and stuff like that, and you go from there. And I see we have our guest is here.
It's a 212 number.
That's her.
And she's here.
All right. So fresh from her endeavors, we have Dr. Martha Eddy joining us here. I'm going to look for the...
You look for the horn, and I'll click her in.
I'm looking for the horn. Okay, click her in.
Well?
All right. I can't find the horn.
Get the horn. Hold on. We have to make our little horn noise, and then we'll introduce you. Hold on.
Oh, I heard it.
Summon the submarine is leaving the dock a little late tonight, but we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Martha Eddy from, just many things. One of them is wellnessCKE.net and the Moving On Center at California.org. So thanks for joining us tonight here on Summertime.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm totally curious what you've been talking to up till now, and happy to be in at this moment. Yeah.
Well, we've kind of been covering a lot of pop culture stuff to try to talk about how some of the stuff you do relates to the dance that goes on in between people's minds. We're trying to get the soma involved a little bit and see if we can enlighten people about maybe taking a different path when some of these conflicts come up. One of the ones we talked about just a minute ago was Rush Limbaugh's stuff that's been bandied about in the news, and he's kind of calling out President Obama on some of these things. And some of your work recently has been really focused on this idea of conflict resolution, using somatic awareness as sort of the bridge. And it just give us, your background's so, diverse and so, and just from a lot of different fields. How did you end up even focusing on that first in the first place? And then how did you ever connect the dots from dancing and things like that, all these things that are more like performance arts, to something as kind of social worky as conflict resolution?
Well, I guess it all starts with my roots, I grew up in Spanish Harlem, and my parents were very much Caucasian, educated, not social workers, and they actually had something to say about the social work profession at the time, but ministers, so very much involved in spiritual work and spiritual action. And it's been interesting. My daughter, who is in the sixth grade, is studying civil rights right now, and it's been fun to get my father, who's 89, to rifle through his notes and sermons to talk about when he was called by Martin Luther King to go down to do a prayer for action kind of civil disobedience to the point of getting arrested in, I guess it's called Albany, Georgia. Little town I hadn't known of. But anyway, you can imagine those were some of the early experiences I had. My father in prison, our family, Harlem. And so when my own studies in health and fitness and somatic awareness circled around to coming back to New York City to start my doctorate, I had an interest in tracking a woman who I made my mentor, and her name is Linda Lantieri. And she had been involved in the New York City public school system. And I'm a New York City public school brat, if you will, from kindergarten all the way through to high school.
Wow,
and
okay.
It just was very meaningful to me that she had done work first in, I guess it really was health education, and then she helped to write curriculum around nutrition education, and then she helped to do work around sex education, and then she was designing a curriculum in conflict resolution. So I just asked if I could shadow her. And ironically, I had to fly out to California to learn from her for our schedules to meet up. So I went out to San Diego and Encinitas and studied with her and watched her working in schools with kids and principals and teachers, and continued that work and became a conflict resolution staff developer for school systems throughout the Northeast and really in California as well when I was living out there through Educators for Social Responsibility. However, as the somatist, as the dancer mover, and that had all been more avocational work, I said, you know, these kids really get this. They are talking the talk. But when it comes down to the moment of crisis, the moment of anger really surging, are they able to walk the talk and walk the walk? And my own feeling was there are more embodied ways to teach this. So that's why I pursued it for my doctoral work.
And were there other people in the field already on that path, or you were just kind of like, you know, getting the old mental sickle out and kind of forging a path on your own there?
Well, it's interesting. I had a doctoral chair who I respect very much, William G. Anderson, and just reading through my dad's civil rights thing, it was a W.G. Anderson that brought him down to Albany, Georgia, so those names cycle around. And Bill Anderson was a specialist in qualitative research long before anybody was doing qualitative research at Teachers College, Columbia University. He started 40 years ago with the first think tank that, oh, schools are cultures, so let's do anthropological research. Let's really observe the complexity of what's happening. Long story short, his own research focused on something called best practices, and looking at experts doing a good job, and let's replicate those models versus attempting to start something new, you know, recreate the wheel, and or just analyze things to shreds. Let's find out what's working and work with that. So I took his advice, and it did involve some sickle work, as you're saying, some real going out and finding where are people already doing this work. I spent over a year just hunting down programs that had conflict resolution that somehow used movement or body awareness. And I actually had to expand the breadth of the field to not just be conflict resolution, but actually violence prevention.
Oh.
And I had to go outside of 9-to-3 school system or 8-to-3 school system and into the after-school programs as well. So that was the first part, and then what I did was I found programs in sports education, coaching,
mm-hmm.
Dance and theater. In one case, a health education program that really was using what she already termed somatic work, and let's see, martial arts. And from those perspectives, was able to get the expertise that I have now.
See, now that's... That is it's an amazing sort of demonstration of diligence, because it wasn't something that was offered to you with a silver platter, or right this way, you know. And you followed a lot of popcorn along the trail there that your mentor left. But at the end of the day, when you're just dealing face to face with the kids,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's one thing. You know, and this is something that Professor Val's dealt with too, in her work at Green Chimneys with some of the kids, you know, with experiencing delays.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is that how does the way a person moves? This is the question we were talking about relate to how they deal with their inner world. Like, you're observing the kid, and they're in their extracurricular activity, whatever it is. And they're kind of like, you almost like lose your body awareness when you're playing a sport or playing a game. And if you're sitting there watching as the sort of anthropological dancer person that understands movement patterns and things, you know which kid is out there and in a flow state and they're coordinated and they're in sync with themselves. And, you know, the other kid that's in their head and they're not really sort of in the flow of the game, maybe they don't understand things. And it's that sort of proving ground that kids use to measure if they're equal with their peers or not. They don't really, you know, on the cognitive side, it's all internal between them and the teacher, them and the test paper, them and the blackboard. It's much more of a mental game. You put them out in the field like this, especially when it's a competitive sport or a team sport, there's a heck of a lot more moments, like you say, that where it's like, can you walk the walk? There's more moments of truth. So how do you use that information of the way a person is moving and relating that to what might be going on in their inner world?
Well, very huge question, really. One would be to give you a bit of an answer of what I'm actually looking for, what type of movement patterns. The other is, when do we use this kind of looking? Because, you know, typical thing is when I tell someone I'm a movement analyst, they go, oh, my God, and their whole body lifts and tightens and says, what did you see about me? And then I get to say, you know, as movement analysts, we're not always analyzing movement. Sometimes we're just hanging, you know, we're just being with, we're in the moment. There's a certain kind of lens that we put on in the moment of doing analysis. It doesn't mean that, or I should say, it also means with this training, there's a kind of filter that makes me aware all the time of certain patterns. So
let me detour right there, because this is one of the things that we were talking about a little before you came on.
Great.
How does that differ from the parade of these body language experts that have been coming out of the woodwork for the last year or two, with a lot of this third-person observation and you know, some of Paul Ekman's work in looking at deception detection? How does what you're looking at and what they're looking at, what's the distinction?
The biggest distinction is that we start with what we see movement-wise as a descriptor. So rather than saying, I'm seeing someone who looks guilty, or they're just moving their arm, or just, this is a second factor. So one thing is, we don't jump to the interpretation right away. We always describe the actual body in space with whatever kind of level of tension or focus or timing that might be going on, for instance.
Okay.
The second factor is that we are always interested in the larger picture. So what's the context? So often I will direct people to then say, okay, what is the question you want to ask of this person? What are the assumptions you're making? And then how can that lead you to more astute question asking? So rather than assuming that what you see is what everybody gets, it's more what you see leads into dialogue. So, of course, that doesn't necessarily go well with soundbite mentality. You know, I can't just tell you what that person's thinking, feeling, and going to do. But I can give you some very insightful questions. For instance, Martha Davis, when she first started, she's a Laban movement analyst, very much a somatic psychologist, and been doing this work for 40 years. She was one of the first to integrate the political analysis or the movement analysis of political candidates with this deeper kind of quality of working. So her question wasn't, who's going to win? Her question is, what kind of leader are they going to be when they do go in office? So it leads you to more decision-making style kinds of questions, propensities towards versus absolutes. And it's something I enjoy about our work. It's not cut and dry. It's about opening up dialogue.
Yeah, and again, one of the things that we talk about a lot in semantics is that it's a first-person science. So the observer is part of the feedback loop, and where in a lot of these other cognitive ones, they're cut off.
Well, not only that, the observer's part of the feedback loop, and we're inviting the observee to also give their opinion. So, for instance, I wrote an analysis of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. When I first had the opportunity to see them, I believe that would have been August 2007, up front and central as they were announcing and beginning their campaigns.
Okay.
And when I wrote the analysis, I wrote it in the kind of second person. So I wanted to share with Hillary what I felt she might want to consider as she continued on her campaign. Likewise with Barack. So rather than, you know, I see this, as you said, it wasn't a third-person diatribe. It was a second-person, hey, might you consider this, because I want one of you two to win, quite honestly.
Now, is one of the glitches or one of the stumbling blocks with semantics, because it is so sort of raw and there is no place to hide in it, that the science end of it, because science is so focused on being basically no interior, everything's exterior, objective, measurable, nameable, fileable, you know, from its roots, that this type of science, this type of approach, because it goes through the skin, gets inside, and it comes up from the inside of the person out, isn't that sort of like it's like wearing your shoes on the opposite feet for most scientists to grasp, because it's so interactive, and that really kind of throws them off in the way that they don't trust it, because they'll say, oh, it's subjective, it's anecdotal, and they throw it away.
Absolutely. I have a million things to say.
Yeah.
One of the founders of the International Association of Dance Medicine and Science, I was a charter member. I helped to organize the conference when it was in San Francisco in 1994. And I gave a speech about somatics, and I believe it was in 1992, and he was there. And I wanted to have the science world, in this case dance science, performing arts science, embrace somatics as just a component of the scientific methodology, scientific outcome, scientific inquiry, scientific pedagogy, whatever it might be. And quite honestly, the organization didn't embrace it. I can say 20 years later they really are coming around, but I guess now it's been 16 years or 17. But it took a while. And I have another anecdote. Just last Thursday, I was in a policy meeting for New York City, mostly educators. They might have been involved in child care or K-12 kind of education. And it was a presentation on the brain, and the infant's brain in particular.
Okay.
So the notion was, what do we know about the developing brain, and how does that affect, or how should it affect, policies that are being set about, for instance, child care, education, what kind of inputs infants are getting from, you know, most likely governmental support.
Mm-hmm.
And right there, amongst the three speakers, the psychologist as scientist was juxtaposed with the neuroscientist as scientist, and they were already a little bit, very politely, at loggerheads, because one was using hard science and the other was using softer science.
Mm-hmm.
So this is definitely still a huge issue. What the hard scientist said at one point was, well, there are studies that show, for instance, that if there's weakness in the arm in early development, neonatal development, then signal patterns from the brain start to shut down. And vice versa, it was implied, if there are certain shutdowns at the central level, you know, obviously we're not going to have peripheral changes. Our arm's not going to move that well. But his point about if there's a problem with the arm locally beginning to shut down the central nervous system, the brain starts to turn off and just say, oh, you know, that's an invalid component of our body, so let's just shut down. That was his leap into, yes, environment makes a difference. Use makes a difference. Learning makes a difference. And I salute him for being able to make that jump. But he wanted the hard, controlled studies to at least get to the point that he got to.
Yeah, and in my experience, I mean, I kind of got tossed into somatics, you know, from my chiropractic training through my son, who was born with some heart anomalies that I had some surgeries early on, ended up with having a partially paralyzed vocal cord.
Mm.
So I spent a lot of nights sitting there with my guidance physiology book opening up, and I noticed, hey, wait a minute, this one nerve goes down and runs around the aorta, and oh, my God, and all these things are connected. And I started getting into things like heart rate variability. So you would go to these brain conferences, and these are the Carl Pilgrim types, you know, these cutting-edge guys, and I would start talking about the heart and training the brain and the mother's heartbeat and things like that. And these guys with these 10-gallon hats, this is a brain conference, son. So the brain existed in this jar, and there was no body attached to it, really. And then there was no felt sense awareness attached to it. And then maybe about 10 years later, little buzzword called neuroception came out. I mean, Stephen Porges was the guy that coined it. And this is the thing where the first order of business is that the organism has to feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
And then in doing that, it starts to develop a narrative that eventually
mm-hmm.
becomes its identity and life story and things like that. So they're starting to build a bridge between,
mm-hmm.
you know, the bells and whistles and all the meat and the gravy, which is what we experience as everyday life. But the Germans really had this down 40, 50 years ago with all their discussion of in that now has become the formal discipline of biosemiotics, where you're talking about someone's Umwelt and they're, you know, what's mine, you know, and things like that, where the surroundings are actually an extension of the self, and there's a conversation, and there's a inside the Umwelt there's an Eigenwelt and there's a Mitwelt and all these German words about you know, things I identify with, things that I identify from, and all, and it's becoming much more, I guess, in psychological circles, it's becoming much more kind of acceptable to talk about internal experience, and guys like Dan Siegel are coming up with terms
mm-hmm.
like interpersonal neurobiology and
mm-hmm.
brains, human with brains. But I got in through the complexity sciences and things like memetics, where you're talking about the transmission of ideas. So, you know, kind of as a like, full circle, the other question I wanted to get to was, now that we know that movement, all these informal modes of learning count, they're not just like dismissed, and they come up with things like multiple intelligence and all that stuff. Now, how does a person who's starting from flat-footed, has never really done any inner work, no contemplative disciplines at all, become more aware of what has been called their experiential anatomy? How would they start? Everyone seems to start with breath. How would you suggest they start?
Well, I'm sort of smirking as I say this, but most people start with pain. So, you know, there's a reason you would put in the time, money, focus to do the somatic work. So you have to have some kind of motivation to open that door, whether it's the deep experience you had with your child or one's own physical pain or some sense that life isn't working to the extent that you want, or maybe less on the pain end of the continuum but still on the learning end of the continuum, wanting to be a better performer, a better accomplished worker, whatever it might be. So that would be a motivator. That would start to open the door. And then how do we actually train people to pay attention to bodily cues? Well, again, it's, for me, what I love about the two systems I'm trained in, one is Laban movement analysis and the other is body-mind centering, but I think that each of the other somatic systems, whether it's Alexander through to Traeger, I call it the A to T of somatic work, would agree that it's an improvisational, again, dialogue or interaction.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, we're going to meet the person and find out what is motivating them. And from that point of motivation, begin to find out what allows them to, as you say, relax enough to slow down enough to feel. So that those are some important markers. We're going to relax. We're going to take away the stress of gravity as is appropriate. Now, if someone really seems like they're going to be uptight lying down either on the floor or a table, hey, we'll sit on a chair or we'll still stand up or we'll lean against the wall. So there's a lot of room for meeting, to use a body-mind-centering principles, meeting people where they are, meeting each person where he or she is. And then these markers, again, slowing down, taking away the effect of gravity, checking in with levels of tension, using breath coordination, as you said. And then from there, playing with principles that are, for instance, shared by both body-mind centering and Laban movement analysis. What is the balance of inner and outer focus? So we're not just interested in this inner, some people would call it navel meditation, but actually interested in taking care of the body for a purpose. So I often say, somatics for what? I turn to my students and say, why are you doing this? Somatics for what? What is your passion? Where are you going to apply this? And that will also impact on the methodologies that you'll want to use within the somatic domain.
Yeah, sometimes I'll tell my clients, it has to matter for you to mind, you know, and what usually, unfortunately, the door that gets them in is, I would say, look, there's three ways in, drama, trauma, or karma. And then you go, okay, now I'll listen. It's like, if you want a good diet, get cancer. You get a great diet, you know. And so a lot of times, what I do, like, it seems to work much better with kids because, you know, as I came up the ranks with my son and my daughter, I would go speak at the, you know, this is like your dad's day to do stuff, whatever. And I would teach the kids some, like, simple exercise like cheer up and calm down with their hands on the desk.
Nice.
You know, and it'd be like cheer up, the hands face up, calm down, hands on the hands on the table, close your eyes. And just that little biofeedback of doing that, their brains are putty enough and kinesthetic enough to go, I like this, I'm going to keep doing this, and I'm going to calm myself down. And maybe 5 or 6 or 10 kids ended up not going on Ritalin when they got a little older because they learned that early on. But when you're dealing with the 45-year-old who is playing his, you know, third set of tennis and he pushed himself because he was at the club and he was trying to impress the boss and he blows out his whole back, he's not going to do calm down, cheer up. He wants someone to come in and be, you know, sort of somatic Jesus for him. And take all the pain away. And so I say, hold your damn breath. If you hold your breath, you create a superseding priority that says no matter what's going on, no matter what I'm thinking about, I need to breathe, and then let the breath leave your body on its own accord rather than you forcing it out. And then you get back a little bit of the cooperation. So it's those bridges, and we've had Stephen Elliott on here talking about coherent breathing and some others, that somatics is not complicated in and of itself. The people that are living the lives without the somatic awareness are complicated. How do we get to the point where it becomes as popular as, like, so how long did it take Pilates to become popular? How long did it take yoga to, like, you know, decades?
Well,
maybe
it's interesting. It's just somatics has been out. I mean, obviously, yoga has been here for thousands of years. Pilates has been here for about the same amount of time. Pilates was on the planet around the same time as Alexander and Rudolf Laban. But, there was something that I feel that Pilates has been a bridge in a way because it is more formulaic. It is more demanding of performance. It has measures. You can feel, you know, whether you're using 1, 2, or 3, or 4 springs. So that is the kind of feedback that people have been trained to expect. And I was shocked when I was doing my doctoral studies that looking at movement in, for instance, physical education basically meant looking at the outcomes of your movement behavior. Did you get the basket in the hoop? Was your movement analysis. It wasn't about what my body did to get that. And then sports psychology came in and we started to look at how the mind was affecting performance. But even so, it took a lot more depth in motor learning and then some of the other areas within movement science to break down the biomechanics of what was going on. But meanwhile, somatics had been doing this for a good 80 years already in a much more holistic way that included motivation from the get-go, bodily performance in relationship to the environment, in relationship to one's goals. So very dynamical systems, actually, you know, complexity theories showing up intuitively in this healing process of the various geniuses and the pioneering generations of somatics that just said, in order to make this happen, I've got to get my mind involved, slow my body down, break up old habits, take a rest for a while, and then let some novel new inputs come in.
We got a quick call here before the show's going to kind of go on the end here to see if we can get her in. You're on with Summertime here. How you doing?
Hi, hello. Am I on?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi. Question for Martha?
Yes. Question. You had mentioned to body language before and how it's sort of like, I don't know if you've ever seen the show Lie to Me, and it's a lot of it is about intuitive body language and trying to figure it out. I had read somewhere in research that that communication from body language is anywhere up to 70 or 80% of communication between two people. And that it's more, I guess you can say, honest than if someone was to tell you something. Can it be the reverse, that body language can lie to you?
That's a great question. There are actually some wonderful studies. The same psychologist that I mentioned, Dr. Martha Davis, has been very involved in studying lying behaviors and the nonverbal components of verbal lies. And I think you're asking a different question. I think you're asking whether or not we can so train ourselves that we can kind of lie with our bodies. And certainly acting is that. That's what we're doing when we act. We're taking on a different persona. If I'm really exhausted, but I want to come over well on a job interview, I'm going to gear up in a way that could be perceived as a lie, not the real me. But on the other hand, if you do it in a somatic way, you can actually connect with, before what Mark was saying about blowing out your adrenal glands and your lower back going out, well, you can actually go back to your breath and find resources that are real. So you're not actually lying. You're just connecting with a different part of yourself. You're kind of broadening.
You got to bring us in for a landing because we're at 10 o'clock and we're out of time,
hey,
so we're not streaming anymore, but it'll be on the replay if anyone wants to listen back. And we'd love to have you on again and get you on for the whole hour if we could and go into some of these topics again soon. And just want to thank you for everything and all the work you're doing out there. And we'll be with you again soon, hopefully here on the air. And thanks for joining us tonight.
Great. Well, thank you. I'd love to talk more about kids sometime because that's where my passion is also.
Okay. We'll get you on
Thanks,
in a couple
Doc.
Of months and do it again.
Yeah,
take care.
You definitely have to come back. See
okay,
you later.
Great. Loved your question.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Take care now. We're back next week if you're still out there listening. We got a secret safe coming on. So for tonight, everybody here, travel light. And thanks to Dr. Ari. Take care.